So thank you very much for coming. I'm going to thank Shoshana in her absence, and I will thank also Steve Roth for once again making this series possible, and thank you to Zeifman's for enabling this and for sponsoring the lunch. Please do make sure to sign in. There is a sheet going around. I have another one available for after that sheet is done. And it's a psychology thing, holding the other page until that sheet is filled in. So once that's filled in, then we'll use the second one. But please do sign in, because inevitably there are things I want to follow up on after this year. Signing in with your email address does not get you added to any email lists outside of the ones for this series. What I'm going to say in this class and in general in all the classes in our series is not intended as psak. This is not a halachic ruling. I'm not even a dayan. I'm not a judge, which you have to be in order to really render decisions on these things. But we'll be looking at halachic sources. And the topics that we picked for this series, the first three of them, all deal with some form of deal that goes bad. Arrangement that goes bad. So our first topic is last-minute cancellations. Our second topic is returning defective products. The third is reneging on a deal, meaning on a purchase. And then the fourth topic is entirely different. It's priorities in staka, as a change of pace. So God willing, we'll be doing this for the next four Wednesdays. The focus for today, in terms of last-minute cancellations, is cancellation by the customer. The truth of the matter is that there's a whole other field, which is cancellation by the business. And that depends on what type of a business it is and so on. So yeah, I had the experience not long ago where I went to the dentist for a cleaning and a checkup. And they did the cleaning and then they told me, yeah, the dentist actually had to leave. He had a funeral he had to go to, so you'll have to come back another time for that. Wait a minute, I made an appointment, but that's... that's a whole other field that has to be addressed. We're not going to even get through everything I would love to get to about the customer canceling, but we're going to do as best we can on that. In Canadian law, verbal commitments are binding. However, there is no law about canceling appointments and requiring payment for that in the Canadian Civil Code. As I understand it, it's considered a private contractual matter. In other words, you make an appointment with a doctor, with an accountant, whatever it is, and the business has some kind of a policy which they inform you of. That policy is binding because you entered into some form of verbal agreement with them by signing up for the appointment. There are some very interesting cases actually out there online about that, about these private appointments and verbal agreements and what happens. There was a fellow who didn't realize he was signing up for phone service and ended up being billed for 3 years of phone service that he wasn't actually using. But he didn't realize that saying yes online actually constituted a legally binding acceptance of the terms. What we're going to look at is, within halakha, verbal agreements to have an appointment for some kind of work. We'll talk about it first, the general issue of verbal agreements. Then we'll move to the discussion of whether making an appointment involves kinyan, any form of transaction that cements this appointment. We'll move from there to the question of, if there is no kinyan, if there's been no formal transaction, do I have any responsibility or can I back out? And then we'll move from that into, if the business is going to lose an opportunity for profit, then do I have any greater responsibility as the person who made the appointment to keep the appointment? And if I cancel, then do I have to pay, and so on. So there are several different pieces to this. We will get through as much as we get through. I'm going to pass around the second sign-in sheet in case the first one is full. Okay. So we begin with source number one. Did my best to keep this all on one sheet this time. Source number one is a passage from the Talmud. Bava Metzia is the volume that we're quoting from. Rav Kahana Yavile Zuzi Akisna. Rav Kahana was selling flax. So he's prepaid for the flax. And Lasov Iker Kisna. And before the time came for him to deliver, flax went up in value. So he says, I sold this at a lower price months ago, but the truth is I'd like to back out now in order to in order to be able to get a better price for my goods. Asla kamei de Rav. So Rav Kahana comes to Rav and asks him, what do I do? Amarle, Rav says, b'may d'nikitas zuzei havlahu. He said, if people prepaid, you have to honor the agreement. You have to give them the flax. That's actually his own discussion as to why that is true. Does transferring money, paying, constitute a transaction? Biblically, we say yes. Giving someone cash constitutes the transaction. Rabbinically, we say no in order to protect the consumer. Because they were concerned about a variation on this case in which you have a warehouse. I want to buy goods from you. I give you money, and then before I take delivery, there's a fire in the warehouse and the goods are destroyed. You say, well, too bad. That was your stuff. I have no obligation to it, and I already have your money. The transaction is already complete. Technically, biblically, you could say that would be valid. So rabbinically, they said it's not true. We want to protect the consumer, and therefore, in such a case, the money would have to be refunded. But he says to Rav Kahana, as far as those who paid, you have to give them the flax. The idach, the rest of it, devarim ninu. It's just a verbal contract. And because it's just a verbal contract, devarim ein bahen mishum mechusarei amana, there is no issue of bad faith when it comes to a verbal agreement. So from this, taking this in a vacuum, and we are not doing that in a vacuum, we have another hour to go, well, roughly. I would conclude from that, verbal agreements are non-binding. Right? Is that what it sounds like? Yeah. That's certainly what it seems. Okay. We continue in that first source. Maisa Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya. Story involving Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya. Sha'amar libno. Say yuskor lanu pavalim. He says to his son, do me a favor, go hire workers. We have a field, we need people to work in the field. Hala upasak lehem mizonos. So he does. He hires the workers, and he makes an agreement with them that he's going to give them lunch. Lo and behold, a lunch will learn out in the field. No, he said he's going to give them. He's going to give them lunch as part of their agreement. Ukshabai tel aviv. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya's son comes home. Amar lo, and he says, father says to him, "Bnei, my son, we have a problem. Afilu ata osa lahem kisuda shlomo b'shaito lo yatzas yidei chavascha. Even if we were to make them a feast like that of King Solomon in his heyday." King Solomon is described as being extraordinarily wealthy, and even if you were to make a feast like one of his, you would not fulfill your obligation imahim with them. Why? Shane, b'nei Avraham, Yitzchak, v'Yaakov. They are descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who are described as also being wealthy, even wealthier than King Solomon, and therefore, you have to give them a tremendous feast. They are heir to a tradition of big meals. So you say you're going to feed them. You can't afford to do that. Ela ad shelo yaschilu b'malachat seve emor lahem almanas she'en lachem alai ela pas v'kitnis bilvad. So do me a favor. Go back to them and say to them, before they get started, before they start work, say to them, you're only promising bread and beans. Okay? Lunch is bread and beans. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. V'isaka daidach devarim yeshban mishum mechusarei amana. If you were to take the view that a verbal agreement is significant enough that a person who doesn't honor it is acting in bad faith, then how could he say to him, go out and renegotiate? You already made a verbal agreement that you're going to provide a feast. You can't now back out and say it's bread and beans. You're changing the agreement. That's the challenge. So the Gemara answers, Sha'ani Hasam. That was different. That's a unique case. They call them Gufayu lo Samcha Da'atayu, because the workers themselves didn't actually expect that kind of feast. Meaning it may be true that their descendants are very wealthy people who made big meals. But they knew they're going out to work in the fields, they're not getting a smorgasbord. They're getting the bread and bean variety. That's what they're getting. Well, in that case, going a little bit further, I'm jumping a little bit. In that case, even if they had started work already, you should be entitled to renegotiate. If they didn't really expect to get a big feast, then why do you have to have a discussion with them before they start work? To which he answers, Hischilu b'malacha vade samchi datayu, because once they begin work, if they actually begin work and no one has said anything new, then they do think they're going to get that which had originally been negotiated. That's the idea. So what we see in this source are a couple of things. Number one, we see that there is some debate going on about the level of bad faith involved in a verbal agreement on which one backs out. Right? That's number one. Number two, we're seeing that there is a possibility for the mindset of the parties involved to dictate whether the agreement has to be honored. You follow? Whose mindset do we care about in this story as we read through this about why he has to get to them before they start working and so on? Whose mindset is the determinant?
Workers.
The workers. Right? The workers are the one who are going to determine, who are going to make this determination. If the workers think this is for real, you're stuck with it. If the workers don't think it's for real, then you can still renegotiate. So what we've done now is really we've changed our tune from the opening line. In the opening line, Rav says to Rav Kahana, you can back out of a verbal agreement and there's no issue of bad faith. But when we get this story about hiring the workers, we suddenly find out that's not true. You can back out and there's no issue of bad faith so long as the people with whom you were negotiating understood that things were still flexible. If they believed that they were agreeing to a particular thing that was going to be honored, then backing out involves bad faith. That's what we see here.
There's no Kenyan.
We didn't discuss Kenyan yet. Correct. We have not gotten to Kenyan yet. That is 100% true. Right now, all we have is you making a statement to them of, I'd like to hire you for such and such. That's it. Let's go to the second source. Source number two, also Talmudic, from a little bit earlier than this passage that we quoted in number one, dealing with backing out on a transaction, and we'll have more to say about this source next week. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Aval Pisha Amru Talis Kone Dinar Zahav, Vein Dinar Zahav Kone Talis, he says, you know, the sages have said that if I engage in a transaction where I'm going to sell you a garment for a gold dinar, if I give you the garment, I have acquired the right to your money. Okay? If the first thing that happens is that I hand over the goods, I now have a right to your payment. The flip side is not true. Paying for it doesn't acquire the goods. And that's something that I talked about briefly before. The money, transfer of money, rabbinically does not qualify in order to acquire the goods. But he continues with what I believe is the more important line for us. Mikol makom, still, kach halacha, this is the law. Aval amru mi shepara me'anshe dor hamabul me'anshe dor haflago me'anshe sedom va'amora umi mitzrayim v'yam, hu asa lipara me'mishena omeid b'diburo. They, an anonymous they, the sages have said, and this is a formula used by a Beit Din, by a Jewish court, may the one, capital O, right, may God, who punished the generation of the flood, the generation of the dispersion, the Dor HaFlaga, the citizens of Sodom and Amorah, Egypt at the sea, may God who biblically carried out punishment on various parties for their various sins at different times, may he also punish someone who doesn't stand by his word. That's a very harsh formulation. I mean, imagine that. You're before a Beit Din, you're before a court, and you say, well, it was only a verbal agreement. Right? And they say, okay, so you won't have to pay anything, but, and then they together, you know, invoke this this curse. I don't want to be standing there at that point. This is a serious formula.
Bro, just a question. Yeah. Isn't the biblical ruling a primary source? Like, wouldn't the law lean towards that, an exchange of money to be the authoritative law?
Right. Yes.
Then the biblical one would...
Then the rabbinic one.
Then the rabbinic one, that's right.
Yes. However, the rabbis have jurisdiction over transactions such that they can say this works or this doesn't work where they see that it's necessary.
Right. Okay.
So that's an example of a case where they felt it was necessary to protect the consumer because otherwise you have the seller has all sorts of license to do not nice things.
Right.
So, what we see here in the concluding line is, verbal commerce does not acquire, but the sages are not pleased with someone who reneges, someone who backs out. So what we see is that, yes, you're supposed to honor your word, and then a third source, honor expectations. This is a passage in Bava Batra dealing with sales. I'll say it outside, you can see it inside. In the event that someone says, I'm selling you land and palm trees, So the assumption actually is that there are going to be trees. And therefore, if there are no trees, I have to go out and buy trees in order to provide them for you. Because I said land and trees, there have to be trees. I have to honor the word that I pledged. Okay, so that shows what we've seen in the first three sources is that there's a certain power to your word. You may not be held to it in the event that the other party understood that it wasn't fixed. But in the event that the other party understood that this is fixed, then you are going to have to honor what you've committed to. What we haven't addressed is, number one, whether there's a need for any form of kinyan, as David noted. And number two, what the payment will be. So let's say you made an agreement like this. And then you say, well, I can't honor it. Let's say he hired them and he said, I'm going to give you food. And they understood that to be a major feast. And he says, well, I don't have the means of doing that. What does he owe them? Does he owe them the feast? Does he owe them some kind of a fine? What exactly will he owe them? Well, I'll give you a case that we're going to see a little bit later. I hire an accountant. Why not? I hire an accountant. I say, I'd like you to do my taxes. Then, when the time comes, I hear from somebody else that he has a brother and he'd like me to go to the brother and whatever, and so fine, so I go hire his brother instead. And I back out of our only verbal agreement. What's my penalty? What should be the penalty? Leave aside what should be the penalty?
No work has been done.
No work's been done. Nothing.
It's cost of setting up, whatever.
If there are, if he
it has cost,
right?
If he loss of potential income.
Well, there's a difference between paying back his costs and paying for loss of potential income. Let's take the following case. Let's say it's now more extreme. Let's say that I have a business and it's an hour outside of Toronto, and I set up that you're going to come to my business and do whatever accounting needs to be done. You're going to do the work there that day. You booked that day on your schedule. You declined other opportunities. You rescheduled other opportunities. And now I say, the day before I say, you know what? Sorry, we decided to go with somebody else. Now what do I have to pay?
At least part of the day, not the full day.
How do you make the calculation?
If he's honest, he'll say, well, from lunchtime onwards, I found another job. Mm-hmm. At least the morning job.
Okay, could be.
There's a limit that the doctors, you need 24 hours in advance to cancel. They can reschedule.
Some,
you
right.
24-hour notice or a certain amount of time, you can reschedule after a certain time in your day.
Right, some level of notice may help. Certainly, that's the way it works in practice. In many businesses, that's for sure true. Well, these are things we need to address. Sorry,
like when they cancel an appointment on you, they weren't like, next time we'll give you a discount, brother.
Right. Indeed. So the customer is going to say to you, next time I'll pay you more. Unlikely.
Does the Gemara offer a formula?
Yes. That's where we're headed. So, first of all, we have to discuss a little bit about this thing called kinyan, the formal transaction. Take a look, please, at source number 4. Source number 4 contends, Hasocher es ha'umnin vihitu ze es ze. Someone hires craftsmen, and they trick each other. What we mean by tricking each other is that one says, either that the employer says, or the craftsman says, I'm going to show up at such and such a date, and then they don't. They don't show up. So, ein lahem ze al ze, ela taromas. The only thing they have against each other is taromas. All they have is a complaint. That's it. You can back out without apparent penalty. However, not so fast. I just want to see where I put this on the sheet.
Wouldn't that involve the curse, though?
Wouldn't that involve the curse? In other words, for backing out, there should be a mishapara. The answer is not necessarily. Right now, it sounds like there's nothing. Right now, it sounds like all there is a complaint and not even the curse. We're going to have to refine this a little bit.
But in mishapara, really, that heaven will punish you. I have no claim on it. I can't get money. I have, you know, you can't wait.
I want to hold the questions because we have to see more sources on it. The point that I wanted to make now, which I thought I put on the sheet, but apparently I didn't because I was trying to squeeze it all on that one page, is the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writes in the Shulchan Aruch, it's Choshen Mishpat Shin Lamed Gimel, that where the customer does something to demonstrate kinyan, to demonstrate a seriousness, there's some transaction, some action that has actually been done to indicate that this is serious, then it's a different ballgame. At that point, backing out is not allowed. The example, the classic example, and this is, you know, a little bit anachronistic, we're not going to see that in our case here, but was that the customer would pick up the equipment of the business person. Picking up the equipment was actually considered to be a form of transaction. And at that point, you can't back out at all. Now, the forms of kinyan don't really apply so much to what we're talking about here. Right? The classic forms of kinyan, picking something up, like, how does that apply when you're dealing with an accountant? The answer is probably it doesn't. However, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, notes that local custom will potentially create kinyan, even where classic kinyan does not exist. So if there is a form of interaction which is recognized in the community as demonstrating serious intent such that neither side is allowed to back out anymore, so signing your name on a document would be one example, at that point that may be binding. That may cross the threshold to say, now you can't back out and just say, well, there's just taromes, there's just a complaint. We may have more than that. So there is a possibility, which needs to be explored more, but there is a possibility of recognizing sort of communal practice. But let's say there's no kinyan. Let's say there's been no agreement like that, just your verbal agreement on the phone, and that's all you had. Is there any responsibility to honor the appointment? So we already saw source number 4 that said the worker has taromes, the worker has some kind of complaint. What exactly does that mean? If you flip the page to source number 9, we're coming back to the other ones. But take a look at source number 9. Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz wrote the Tiferet Yisrael commentary to the Mishnah. And he wrote on this statement that we said that the worker has only taromes. He says, Midaloka Omar Yeshlem Taromet Ze El Ze. He says, the wording in the Mishnah was not, this one has a complaint against this one. It said, this one only has a complaint. The word only indicates this is minimal. All he has is a complaint. So he says, Kamash Malan, this teaches us, that there is no obligation, not even to satisfy heaven. Not even this Misha Para God is going to punish. Nothing. Taromes means you're not happy. The person who feels he got cheated is not happy. And that's it. No further obligation is involved according to this source. Mind you, people will avoid entering into such a situation. You don't want to create a taroma situation with your customers, because if you do, they won't go to you anymore. So that Rabbi Moshe Isserles discusses the issue in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, where there's a certain business transaction that takes place. And the businessman said something, business person said something, and there were two ways to interpret what that person said. It could be interpreted to mean this commitment. It could be interpreted to mean that commitment. We don't know. It really could have been either way. And the courts are now charged with figuring out, what did that person mean? They have to read his mind. What did he mean when he entered into it? If one possible meaning would have led to taromes, we assume that's not what he meant. If taromes again means the complaint. If that would have caused people to complain, then even though he's not legally bound by anything, nonetheless we assume that's not what he had in mind. He would not have had in mind something that was going to get people angry at him. We assume that people don't want a taromes situation. Taromes only exists where there is some kind of an impact on the business. He's going to suffer in some way. One other note, though. Take a look at source number 10. Source number 10 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, says, if you hire somebody and you say, I would like you to irrigate the field, right? There's a river. I want you to use the river to irrigate the field. And the river stops. The river dries up at midday. So if the river doesn't normally dry up, then it's the loss of the worker. The employer doesn't owe him anything. What are we saying in this source? Source number 10?
Act of God.
Act of God, right? Unpredictable event. No one can complain about me backing out if I back out for a reason which anybody would identify with, such as the river dried up, and I had no way of knowing this was going to happen because the river never dries up. It's one thing if I should have been able to predict it, but where I can't predict it, no one is going to hold anything against me. So this most basic level of complaint, of you shouldn't have done that, isn't going to apply where it's not really my fault. What about where keeping the appointment would have a cost for me? Can someone complain Torchino did a bad thing by backing out if I backed out for more than just, well, I wanted to use somebody else, but because there was a cost involved? What then? You follow the question? So if you take a look, I'm going to jump a little bit in the interest of time, but take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 is dealing with a purchase. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law, in the Shulchan Aruch, says, Ra'oi la'adam lamod b'diburo, afal bishalo asa shum kinyan, rak dvarim ba'alma. He says, one should keep his word even without a formal transaction, even if it's just words. V'chol achozer bo, and one who backs out, bein lokeach, bein mocher, whether it is a buyer or a seller, ein ruach hachamim nocha imenu, the sages are not pleased, and that's where you get the Mishapara case, that curse, where they back out. But, v'hani mili b'chad tara, that assumes the price was the same the entire time. Avol betray tari, but if the price changes, so the price goes up and the seller says, you know what, I don't want to honor my agreement. Or the price goes down and the buyer says, I don't want to honor my agreement. So if all you had was a verbal agreement, then we'll say that's not bad faith, that's understood. You're not expected to stick to it where it would have cost you. That's made even stronger in source number 8. Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein talks about, and I'll say it outside, where the employer doesn't need the work because of a change in his business. Meaning that someone hires you and says, I would like you to take care of, I don't know what, it's easiest in the field cases. He says, I'd like to hire you to do the harvest. But then locusts come along and they eat up the harvest. Now what is he going to do? There's no reason for him to go ahead with this. It doesn't make any sense. And therefore he's entitled to back out. Or he finds out, these are horrible workers, they're going to ruin half your stuff. He's entitled to back out. So what we're saying is, this most basic level of complaint is being walked back. We first said that verbal agreements are important, that someone who backs out of a verbal agreement may get this horrible curse by the Beit Din, by the court. Right? We said that one should be trying to keep his word. But we've walked it back and said, number one, if it's just a complaint level thing, then you don't have any real obligation, real world obligation. It's just something you want to avoid. And we said that if your reason for backing out is financial loss, then it's legitimate for you to walk away. And certainly where the agreement makes no sense, it's legitimate for you to walk away. Like where there's no harvest to harvest anymore. Right? Is everyone clear with this? But these are all in the realm of the complaint department, so to speak. These are all in the realm of taromes, when the person you contracted with is simply going to be unhappy and you'd like to avoid people being unhappy.
We have a question.
Yeah.
Let us say you're dealing with somebody who might not be fully qualified to do the job, even though he does not do this business. For example, let's say you take a builder and say he's not licensed, for plumbing he's not licensed. Does that come under then this particular category here? Because according to common business practice, You should not have to do business with people unless they are licensed in that particular area.
Right. But did I have the chance to know that when I made the agreement and I overlooked it? How did I not know that before?
I suppose we should all know that we don't do business without people who are not licensed.
Right.
We don't do business with people. You do not have a license to do the job.
Right, but if I hire such a person, I'm clearly aware of that at the time and I'm ignoring it.
If you are aware of it, then...
If it's something I couldn't have known beforehand, then yes, that will be grounds under this to cancel. If it's something that I knew and I didn't decide mattered, and then I found out, you know, why I should care, because I heard some horror story or whatever it is, then maybe there's room to make the argument, also I didn't know before, now I know. It depends on the level of knowledge involved at the time you make the commitment. So, again, all we've dealt with so far is sort of this realm of taromes, this realm of complaints. But things get more serious when you cause the business a loss. That's where things get more serious. Take a look, please, at source number 11. And that goes back to the case of the accountant who traveled an hour outside of Toronto or who cleared his day to be able to travel an hour outside of Toronto. Source number 11, Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. When do we say that all you have is a complaint? Bishalo halchu, where the workers didn't actually travel to the business. Okay? Or in our case, where the business person you made the appointment with didn't go to work. I'm sorry, already went to work, actually. He showed up in the office. Davka bishalo hayu yecholam lahaskir atzmam emesh. So where do we say that they only have the complaint if the workers... I'm sorry, I butchered that line. I was going too fast. Where do we say that if the workers did not travel to the office, all they have is just a general complaint? That's only where bishalohal yecholam lahaskir atzmam emesh kishesachram bala bayis zeh. They can only... You can back out without any repercussions if, at the time that you hired them, they didn't have any work anyway. So it's not as though your cancellation cost them. However, avalam hayu niskarim emesh, but if yesterday they could have found other work, v'achshav einu niskarim klal, and now it's too late, now they're going to lose the day, Hareza kedaber ha'avud lahem. It is considered to be a loss for them. V'nosei lahem scharam kepawal batel, and you have to pay them like a worker who has nothing to do. V'chol elu adinim. I'm sorry. So let me pause with that. What the Shulchan Aruch, what the Code of Jewish Law is saying is that in the event that they could have had other work and now they can't, you pay them like a worker who has no work to do. What does that mean? It means the following. Let's say you are, I'm going to come back to the accountant again. Let's say you are an accountant, and let's pretend that it's possible to say, I know that it's not, but let's pretend it's possible to say that on a given day you make $1,000 for being at work. You have the choice of not going to work on a given day, but then you're going to lose $1,000. So you say to yourself, yeah, but I gain a day at home. How much would someone have to pay you to get you to stay home? Half. Is that true in general?
Depends. There's no way to objectify the payment.
Why?
Because everyone's different.
Okay, but I'm asking for you. Fine.
But how can that be generalized to a lot?
That's a good question. And maybe you can't. But that's the standard. The standard that we give is that you pay based on what it would cost to get him to stay home. To get him to just take the day off. He can kick back in the easy chair. He can mow his lawn, whatever he wants to do. How much money would it take to get him to stay home? That's the amount that you have to pay him, because now that's exactly what he's going to have to do. That's the idea. Worth noting, he continues here in source number 11, that once again, if the employer is not at fault because something unpredictable happened, then the employer does not have to pay. But otherwise, if the person who made the appointment backs out, and as a result, you're losing money, he has to pay you whatever it would have cost to get you to cancel your appointment and stay home. That's the idea. Now, this is a problem. The reason why it's a problem is because we're requiring someone to pay even though all he did was cause intangible harm. There's nothing you can point to. Now, even if you know that you make $1,000 a day, it's not as though I went and destroyed $1,000 of your material property. I just caused you not to be able to gain $1,000 for this or for someone else's appointment today. Do we have a precedent in Jewish law for actually, you know, suing under such circumstances? Do we have the ability to say that I'm going to demand payment from you when you didn't really hurt me in any recognizable material way? Take a look at source number 12. They deal with a very interesting case. Let's say I have an IOU from somebody. Somebody owes me money. I sell to somebody else the right to collect that debt. That's what it deals with here in number 12. So I sold it to somebody. I'm going to pick on Chaim. I sold Chaim the right to collect that IOU. And then I went to the person who had borrowed the money from me in the first place, and I canceled his debt. I say, yeah, I forgive you the debt. Guess who's out of luck? Chaim. Chaim is out of luck, because now he has a worthless piece of paper. So there's a debate in the Talmud as to whether you can penalize somebody for what's called dina de garmi, which means harm that was catalyzed by someone, right? I caused him the harm, but it's not... There's nothing physical you can point to. You're still holding the same piece of paper that I sold you in the first place. So there's some debate as to whether we're actually going to punish for that. So
Sorry, Rabbi, how is that even possible? When Chaim gets that obligation, he buys that right to that debt. So when that person goes and says, you know, don't worry about it, I forgive you. Well, it's not yours to forgive anymore because it's no longer your debt.
Right, because that's not what he did. You're right, but he didn't buy the debt. Okay. All he bought was the right to collect a certain amount of money from so-and-so. He didn't, in that case, he didn't actually buy the debt.
Correct.
Just the right to collect it, which is an oversight on your part, and I hope you've learned your lesson. But the point for us is we have to decide how exactly are we approaching this. Why is it that if I cost you money by canceling, you're able to charge me for this poel batel, this set of the price of keeping you at home? So there are three different theories. One theory is that this is what's indeed called dina de garmi. This is the view suggested by Tosfot. I didn't bring all the sources on here in the interests of time, but one view is that yes, we will punish people for causing a loss, even though it was done in this non-physical, non-material way. That's one approach. Second approach, which you saw in source number 11, it was in the wording of the Shulchan Aruch, is that this is called a davar ha'avud. I caused him a loss. He lost money. In other words, the way I could look at this is that he had a right to certain funds, and now that money is no longer going to be his. I caused him to lose to lose what he expected to gain. That's a fuzzy category. The third view is that it's a debt as a product of our financial arrangements. When I contracted with somebody and said, I am going to show up at your office and the bill is going to be $150 or whatever it's going to be, it's as though I promised to pay you $150. I actually owe you that money. And even though I didn't use the services, that's not your problem, that's my problem. I'm the one who backed out. And therefore, I still owe you the $150. That's another way that you can look at it. That's presented by Rabbi Akiva Eger at the end of Avot Metzia. The Chazon Ish brings it as coming from the Ritva earlier. I am responsible for that payment. I guaranteed it at the time that I made the appointment. Now, this matters. The legal theory matters. In terms of whether we call it a tort, meaning it's as though I harmed you, I caused you the loss of those funds, or whether we call this a debt. Some examples of why this matters. Let's say I hired you to do a job for me. At the time when the price for doing that job, the salary for doing that job, would have been $200. However, now, for whatever reason, there's a glut of people who can do that job. The value of the work has dropped. Now, it's only $100 by the time by the time it comes around. And I back out. Do I have to pay you based on what I guaranteed initially, the $200? Or do I have to pay you based on the going rate now, which is $100? So the answer is, it depends. If what I owe you is Dina Degarmi, is the tort, then all I cost you is what it would have been for you now, the $100. That's what you lost today, $100 worth of work. However, if it's based on what I guaranteed to you at the time that I made the appointment, then it's $200 that I cost you. So our evaluation changes based on how we understand what exactly is involved. There are other examples that we could give of the, you know, for why this matters. My scan in the Beit Midrash, Rabbi Weintraub, wrote an article in which he contended that it has ramifications for what's a very common case, the barber case. You make an appointment at the barber. My barber doesn't take appointments, but you make an appointment at the barber, and you say, "I'm going to be there at 11 o'clock on Wednesday." Then, whatever, something comes up, you can't make it 11 o'clock on Wednesday, you call him back and say, I'm going to come next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. So now do you have to pay him kapoa batel? Do you have to pay him like someone who's staying home? You're honoring the agreement, you're just doing it a week later. Right? He's not losing your money. On the other end, he can't fill that time anymore. So if I look at it as a tort, you're responsible for the money loss, the financial loss that he's suffering right now. And in that case, it could be argued that if he previously could have booked that spot and now he can't, all his appointments are booked and so on, then I have to pay him, even though next week I'm coming back anyway. But if all I did was guarantee to him, I'm going to pay you the price of a haircut, I am. I'm just doing it a week later. So it matters which theory is involved will actually influence the results. So what we've said, again, to make sure that we're clear, is that number one, where there's no kinyan, where there's no active transaction that's taken place, and where he hasn't lost an opportunity for profit, at most he has a complaint against you. And if the reason for backing out wasn't predictable, or if the if you backed out for cause, then he doesn't even have that complaint. That was number one. Number two, if there was a kinyan, there was an active transaction, or you caused him a loss, now you have to pay him kapoel batel, like a worker who's being paid to stay home, an amount we are about to define. And that amount may be pegged to, or maybe defined as based on a tort that you caused him harm, but maybe not. It may be based on it may be based on the idea that you owe him the money because of the agreement that you made initially. So how much does one pay? You backed out, now what? So industry standard is very important to us. Like I said before from the Aruch HaShulchan, where there is local precedent, where there is some kind of an agreement between people that this is the way we do business, that's what we're going to work with. What about where there is no industry standard to be able to work with? So, if you take a look on your sheet, the phrase that we used in source number 11 was, you need to work on the sheet, in the middle of source number 11, was kipoel batel, how much it would take to get him to sit at home and not work. How much is that? Well, Rashi, best known for his commentary on the Chumash as well as on the Talmud, but also a serious legal authority in the 11th century, Rashi argues that it's half of one's wages. It was very funny to hear somebody actually say half before. The half is the amount that Rashi says, half of his normal wage, and that gets quoted by the Taz on the Shulchan Aruch. Others disagree and say it's more subjective. As Chaim noted, it's really a hard thing to categorize because it depends on the kind of work I do. But not only does it depend on the kind of work I do, it depends on the unique elements of my personal circumstances. And it depends on why you backed out. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Heller wrote the Ketzot HaShulchan commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. And he says, if an employer wishes to renege, and he could have kept the commitment, it wouldn't have hurt him at all to honor his commitment. He just decided. And now he wants to reduce the pay and pay him kapoel batel like an idle worker, he lacks the power to reduce it. The workers wanted to work. If you wanted to be there working, and he had no reason to back out, then he can't say, well, I'll just pay you to stay home. He has to pay you in full. That's the statement of the Ksod HaChoshen. That's number one. In another case, source number 15, this is remarkable. We get the idea that there are workers who actually suffer if they don't show up at work. The case he's talking about are people who engage in manual labor. And apparently, to stay in shape, they needed to work. If they don't have work and they stay home, they fall out of shape, and then they come back to work and they get Charlie horses or whatever it is. They need the work, and you are hurting them by not hiring them, and therefore there's no amount of money you can pay them that would justify them staying home. So you have to pay them in full. That's another case that gets quoted. Another one, Rav Aharon Akar is a judge in Israel, and he points out, sometimes when you're dealing with a professional, there is no option of staying home. I made a doctor's appointment for 12:30. Then I cancel it, because I forgot I had a shear here at Zeitman's. So I back out of my 12:30 appointment. The doctor's not going to go home at 12:30 and then come back at 12:50. Right? It doesn't make any sense. So there, I'm going to have to pay him in full, because I'm not really paying him to stay home. He's not staying home. So this idea of paying the person based on what it would take to get them to stay home really is going to be very case-dependent. It's a nice idea in theory, but in practice, it's a lot harder to apply. So, again, just to sum up that last section, we talked about paying someone for his lost profit, and what we say is that number one, industry standard governs. Where there's no clear industry standard, we have the rule of poel batel, paying him as whatever it would take to get him to stay home, which Rashi defined as half his normal wage, others disagree with. But that won't even apply in cases in which either he wanted to work, he doesn't want to stay home, and it's you backing out without even having cause. If you have cause, it's a different story, but you don't have cause. Or where sitting at home is actually bad for him, or where he doesn't have the option of sitting at home. So I hope this was a good introduction to the topic. There is way much more to say. But questions? Yes, Chaim.
Getting back to the Kesod number 14, how does that square with the Mishnah in Bava Metzia number 4? Where do we say this Torah is not Torah? Same thing as 7 and 8 with the Ramah.
Right. So, I mean, 14 squares in a fairly straightforward way, right? 14 was where you want to renege, and you could have kept the commitment. Because 4 is dealing with the case in which he's not suffering a loss. They'll go get something else, or where they didn't have other work options in the first place. That's what 4 was talking about. So I think that addresses your other questions also about 4.
Well, 7 and 8 also doesn't talk about any loss. There it just seems to go against what the Mishnah says.
In 7 and 8, where we make the statement that one should, well, 7, the Ramah says, you should stand by your word, and if you back out, the sages are not happy, is talking about a sale. It's not dealing with a case of loss at all. It's a sale discussion. So there's no, the two don't match. They're talking about two different things.
Well, can we consider the hiring of an employee the same as a sale?
Well, not in terms of loss of work. In other words, the analogy would be, I am the buyer in the sale case, and I am the employer in the work case. But as the buyer, if I choose not to buy this item from you, I guess there could be a loss case where he lost a potential customer because he held it for me. So then you have that analogy. But that's not the assumption here, but that would be an appropriate analogy, I suppose, yes. And then the rules that apply by not hiring a worker will now have to be applied to the case of backing out of the sale. In terms of number 8, where he backs out, that's because of a new circumstance, something that wasn't known before, and it made the hire meaningless. There was no way to put them to work, and that's considered justification, so that there is no bad faith involved at all. Sure, you ask tough questions. Others? Okay, thank you very much. Again, we have next week is the second one, the returning.